Hello, everybody. Welcome to the New in Chess podcast. My name is Dirk-Jan ten Geuzennam, which for good reasons is often shortened to DJ. The New in Chess podcast is brought to you by DGT, the leading producer of chess clocks and sensory chess boards that are used in major and minor competitions all around the world. Today, my guest is Dutch Grandmaster Luc van Wely. Luc is a 8-time Dutch champion. His career peak was in 2001 when he made it to the World Top 10 with a peak rating of 2714. Luc is also a successful coach who worked with stars like Gata Kamsky, Vladimir Kramnik, and Veselin Topalov, and more recently with the Italian national team and Dutch GM Max Warmerdam. What's more unusual is that Luc can also look back on a political career, as he was a senator in the Dutch First Chamber from 2019 to 2023. Luc, welcome. How are you doing?
Hi, DJ. Thanks for having me. And it's it's nice being here. So, and I'm actually looking forward to this podcast, which I heard a lot about. And but I didn't have time to listen to the other podcasts you did already. But I guess this one will be slightly different than the other ones, I hope.
That's what we all hope, Luc. We met about a week ago in Prague, and then you traveled to the Netherlands back, and then this weekend you were in Germany again. A busy man. What were you doing in Germany?
Well, yeah, I was playing in German Cup and trying to qualify for the German Cup final, which actually we did, not thanks to me. But I was kind of struggling, but I had such a busy schedule, and although I have to say I'm extremely fit, I still start to feel the fatigue a bit, you know, and also Prague and the organizer over there, Bolek, he always invites you for some Slivkovic and stuff like that, you know, and I'm not as an experienced drinker as, for example, Ivan Sokolov, you know, and I start to feel it, you know, but...
Yeah, but you managed, and, despite all your travels, you look fit. Let's refresh the memories of some of our listeners and introduce you to the ones who are less familiar with your exploits on the chessboard. Looking at your career, which achievements as a chess player do you yourself rank highest, or do you think back to with most satisfaction or pride?
Well, actually, I was born in 72, and actually the sweetest memories are actually from your youth, you know, when actually I finished once third in the World Junior Under 16 in 87. And Kamsky was playing, Joël Ochè was playing, Michael Adams was playing. Actually, it was won by Hannes Stefansson, an Icelandic GM. That time, very gifted, but, you know, you see Kamsky, Adams, Ochè finally became stronger than him. But, you know, the Icelandic community was, you know, so close, and a lot of GM power there. So... This was very sweet, and actually the most exciting experience I had was once I came quite far in the FIDE World Cup in 97 in Groningen. I reached the quarterfinals playing Mickey Adams, and unfortunately I didn't manage to win a night endgame 2 pawns up. It costed me like $100,000 at least.
Because every round the prices were almost doubled, right?
Or? Yeah. So at that moment I was guaranteed like 100K. So if I would beat Mickey, it would have been 200K. And then semifinals, my good friend, old friend Nigel Short was waiting for me. I would double down again. So
yeah.
So it would have been 400K. Okay, probably final I would lose to Vichy or not. Let's be modest.
But even by reaching the quarterfinals, you won a nice amount, and I think that amount became legendary when you turned it into a car, didn't you?
Yeah, well, let's say half of the money was spent on taxes, and half of the money was spent on a BMW 5 Series. Yeah. So 8 months later or something, I crashed the BMW, but okay, that's a part of the deal, you know. It's cars have to be used, and
Yeah, but you used it thoroughly because it was a total loss, wasn't it?
No, it was not total loss, but the damage was pretty serious. Yeah, but the car is still. My father is now driving this car.
So it's still around.
Still around. So
yeah, well, you won the Dutch championship 8 times between 2000 and 2017. What impressed me a lot at the time was when you were winning all those opens, the huge opens. You won several of them. I think Berlin, New York, the Rubinstein Memorial, and in a way it said a lot about your playing style. I mean, I thought it was very brave that you entered those competitions because there were tons of former Soviet players. It was really tough, and but it was a challenge that you liked a lot.
Yeah, I have to say that those days seem to be now so far away because I cannot really imagine myself playing these kind of events right now because, you have a family and you don't want to travel, so much. But I mean, back in the days is when I won in 91, I think it was the Berliner Sommer with all those Soviet GMs. This was really something special. Then later I traveled a lot to the US where basically I won New York Open, I won the World Open. I mean, I won Foxwoods, Chicago. I mean, basically I won, I don't want to be modest, but I think I basically won almost every tournament in the US.
Well, you even waited with the Chicago Open until, 2010? I mean, that was much later than the other ones.
Well, I didn't wait. I think it was just the first time I played it, so I don't know.
That really was the first time you went there.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and I basically, it was also the time that I started to date my current wife, Lorena Zepeda. You know, she's from El Salvador. And we're basically meeting in the U.S. somewhere in between, you know, playing a tournament together and combining with some holidays, yeah?
Yeah.
So, and of course, for holidays, you need some spending money. Yeah?
Yes, so you went to pick that up in Chicago.
Yeah, but at some point, I think the organizer, I think it was Bill Goitsberg, he started to charge you like 30% taxes, you know, which was very difficult to reclaim from the IRS, you know. Mm-hmm. Things got a little bit less funny.
Yeah.
And end story, in 2012, when I got deported from the US, made it even harder to win some tournaments in the US.
You haven't been there since 2012. And can you explain why that is?
Yeah, so basically in 2012, it was business as usual. I was traveling to the US and I was going to play some chess, going to play some poker, and some holidays, and maybe 2 or 3 days I was going to give some lectures, you know. And basically it just was not about making money or whatever, because if I would break even on the trip, I would be very happy. So I was probably going on a 2.5 month road trip. But basically when you arrive in the US, I think I arrived in Newark Airport. They ask you what you're coming to do, and I basically I was honest, or you can call me stupid or whatever, but I was basically frankly speaking what I was going to do.
Yeah.
Not really thinking that about the consequences that actually in the US they consider if you give a lecture or training, it's considered to be work, and for that you need a work visa. So basically it's I mean, they have this kind of zero tolerance policy, and you're going to be deported. And
they refuse you entry, and you had to go back.
Yeah, you go back, and then to re-enter again the US, it's really pain. It's like 1 day paperwork. I tried it once. 1 day paperwork. You pay €150 up front. And the guy at the U.S. Consulate thought he was like the last line of defense. And within 5 minutes, I was standing outside with a letter of refusal or denial, whatever you call it. So that's not so funny
yeah. and not practical. Funny. I mean, yeah. So that it would take a major effort to get that corrected.
Yeah, although these days, we get to back that later. You know, since I was in the Senate, I have also a diplomatic passport, so it gives you some extra opportunities, but I didn't really use them so far.
Yeah. Well, many people, they know your nickname, which is King Luke, which is a name that you chose yourself. Well, when did you choose it and why did you choose it?
Yeah, well, actually, I was kind of lucky, you know, because it was early 90s, you know. I moved to, after my high school time, I moved to Nijmegen, and I was supposed to study there, but since I didn't pass my final exam, but anyway, I decided to live there. Mm-hmm. So basically, I was traveling a lot, but while being at home, I was just going to the university. They had some nice computers with internet connection, and I was going to play Blitz online on ICC. All right. Yeah. So I think it was one of the first, it was like 93 or something, to play online. And people from the US, from Iceland, and I think Amor Diaki from Qatar, they were also, he was also there.
I was also there already.
Yeah, they were there. I mean, they had this good infrastructure. So, yeah. So, and okay, you have to pick a name, and then you pick a name, and okay. And it was one of the first, and whatever reason, I just chose King Luke, and I was the first, so first on the throne, and nobody kicked me off, you know. So, yeah. The legend must live.
Yeah, it also says something about you. I mean, the bravado, the looking for challenges, both on and off the chessboard. I mean, is it part of your character?
Yeah, challenges, you need to keep challenging, especially yourself. Yeah, but I mean, it would of course it would be nice if you have a few natural enemies, you know. But back in the days, let's say in the 90s, we had, of course, in Holland, I had the rivalry with Jeroen Piquet and Jan Timman. It was kind of nice to her, but Timman is getting a bit older. I'm not, but. Also later, for example, we had Ivan Sokolov. He confessed to me, look, you were actually the one who kept me going, because I knew that if I would just if I would not keep on going, you would screw me badly. so that was so. Yeah, it's always good to have some kind of new. Then at some point Anish came, but Anish is now a bit
Anish Giri.
Yeah, Anish Giri. Yep. He's top 10 player. And then you have Jordan van Vereest, of course, always teasing him, and working sometimes with Max Wammerdam. He's 23 and more or less the same rating. He is a bit higher right now. So, and it's always good to have keep some competition, and and also which is within sort of your reach. It's not of course I always enjoy teasing Magnus, let's say on chessboard it's not going to be so funny, let's say on the football pitch, for example, he's really suffering a lot there.
Yeah, I remember several football matches in Wijkenshaven, Team Luke against Team Magnus, and which often were bloody affairs, literally.
I came back to the hotel room, and I went to undress and went to take a shower, and then my wife told me, but look what happened to you. I said, what do you mean, what happened to you? Look at your body, it's full of bruises and everything. It's like
you were really black and blue.
Just in the heat of the battle, we didn't notice all these body checks and stuff like that, which Magnus, he's also not flinching. Yeah, he's just doesn't give you an inch space. I felt also I had to just couldn't let it to be a one-sided affair. Yeah, so I probably also had some. You got some beating as well. So
Yeah, well, there have been a couple of those matches. Do you know what the overall standings are now?
Well, let's say we had a lot of unofficial matches, but we were playing on some random court and it was a bit snowy, and that's why there was a lot of physical contact. And later it went to the official part. We played in the official stadium of Telstar, close to Wijk aan Zee.
Yeah, that's a professional club, right?
Yeah. They play in the second division, but nevertheless, I mean, they're professional players. Yeah. And I know that Team Look beat Team Carlsen in the first match, mm-hmm. and then I think the organizers realized that this was maybe not the outcome which should be, you know.
Yeah.
And just to please Magnus a bit more, and Magnus should win and should score a few goals and stuff like that, you know. So the later encounter next year, this was Team Magnus won. It was like a typical North Korean kind of match fixing or whatever. You know,
it was nothing you could do there.
And I'm just there to give the victory of Magnus a bit of credibility. But okay, it's So yeah, if Magnus, let's say, off the board, we had many nice battles, you know, either playing cards or football, or there's always some interesting challenge.
Well, what I always thought interesting was the way you publicly challenged opponents or rivals. And so it's not only that you're challenging yourself, which I think is an intrinsic part of your character, but that you also express them and that you like to place bets and wagers. And not only connected to chess.
Yes, yeah. Okay, although, you know, I know one guy who's also challenging everybody, which is Hans Niemann.
Uh-huh.
But and he's also calling his shots. But, you know, but my case is slightly different, because when I'm calling my shots, sometimes, I cannot keep up with my words, yeah? So it's kind of, I have to take the long walk of shame sometimes. So that's part of it, you know. So yeah, so had some funny bets here and there, but yeah, sometimes you pay the price for having when your mouth's too big, you know. You have to pay up for that.
Yeah. So sometimes it costs you money.
It's more about your pride. Sometimes you have to swallow
as you said, the walk of shame.
More
let's turn to another remarkable thing in your life, that is the remarkable career switch that you made in between 2019 and 2023, when you entered politics. How exactly did that come about?
Yeah, actually we have to go a few years back, because I knew one guy, his name was Kees Eldering. He's the owner of this site hotels.nl, and he was sponsoring a chess team in Groningen as well. And I was playing for his team, and we spoke a lot and we had a few drinks here and there, so he knew basically where I was politically standing, yeah. So in 2016, he approached me. He said, "Okay, look, do you want to be on the candidate list for the election for this new party, Forum for Democracy?"
Forum for Democracy.
Yeah, Forum for Democracy. Yes. Yeah. This was like a new party. It should be like a new wave in politics about to give. For me, politics always was something, dirty, yeah? Like a dirty word, yeah? So
that's what you thought it was.
Yeah, I still think. But anyway, the guy approached me and said, "Do you want to do this?" I said, I need to think about it, because, you know, of course, I like to take risk here and there, but still I wanted to make some impact analysis on what could do this to my damage to my reputation, because I think.
As a person and a chess player, or?
Yeah, well, I mean, I didn't care so much about a chess player, but as a person, yeah. But anyway, I told the guy I need to think about it, and the guy said, okay, you have 1 hour to decide. Okay. All right. So I gave it a quick thought and said, okay, what the hell? Okay, let's go for it. And the party got the 2 seats in the parliament, and that was it. And basically, I was too busy anyway with my chess. With my son was born in 2016. 2017, I moved. So I was too busy anyway. Then 2 years later, I got approached again by the leader of the party, Thierry Baudet, also a chess player, by the way. This was sort of the kind of connection. Yeah. And he said, okay, look, do you want to be a member of it? Do you want to be on the candidate list for the Senate, for the first chamber? I said, yeah, okay. Yeah, you can put me there. So he said, oh, yeah, you get you put you on the ninth place. And yeah, because you're not in the inner circle. Yeah, yeah, fine. I don't care. Fine.
Yeah, so it looked like there was not really a chance that you'd be elected.
Yeah, and also I didn't care so much because also let's say you have a lot of people who actually care a lot and they try to push themselves, you know, to get a higher spot. And also, okay, they put me also on the list for the parliament for the province. I think I was on the seventh spot. Anyway, long story short, we crushed the elections. And there I was suddenly a senator and sort of also a member of the parliament of my province, North Brabant. So
both, yeah, both.
Both, yeah. So yeah, this was already quite something. And I thought, okay, you know, since I'm already active in politics, why not actually found a local political party? So I also have my own political party, which got into the city council since 2022. Uh-huh. So, well, in case I had nothing to do, you know, like...
So suddenly political life was very busy.
Yeah, so I was busy at three levels. Plus, okay, I was, we get back to that later, I was also coach of the Italian national team. Mm-hmm. Playing something myself, and father of two young kids.
Yeah, so suddenly a very busy political life. Look.
Yes, but okay. Sometimes okay. Let's say you jump on the bandwagon, as they call it. You know, it's an opportunity they come to in your life, and you have to adapt to it. And basically, I believe that okay, you are. You maneuvered yourself in some sort of position which creates different opportunities, like politics in this case.
Yeah.
I still believe that politics is still a dirty word, and it's not a very funny world to be in, you know. But it was very interesting experience, though.
Yeah. But you said that you were approached because this gentleman, he knew where you stood politically. You joined a party that, created a lot of controversy in the Netherlands. And at some point, you also left that party. Can you say something about your political beliefs and why you left them?
Yeah, well, actually, this political party was supposed to be, let's say, the new way of how to approach politics. Yeah. So basically they want to attack, let's say, certain subjects which was basically people prefer not to speak about, you know, because it's like very sensitive subjects. And also they believe that decisions are not made like for example, like in chess, you have the best move. Yeah. But in politics, it's not about best moves, it's about having the right connections, the right friends and stuff like that. So, but yeah, this is what I liked. And also I liked sort of, you know, when you just, in some way they were kind of, let's say, politically incorrect, you know, it's, but politically incorrect means like, okay, you just say what you think and you don't care about the consequences of, you just say what you think is the truth and you're very open about everything. But okay, later, yeah, the party became in, it started to go into the wrong direction.
And the wrong direction was?
Well, it became a little bit, it started with some absurd theories and, you know, a lot of, too many, let's say, conspiracy theory, too many conspiracy theories, which, okay, I like the idea of, you know, philosophizing, for example, who could be, let's say, the benefactor of, for example, 9/11 or whatever. There's always people who, let's say, profited from that. But it doesn't mean that they did it, you know? It's just that, okay, they just profited from it. Yeah, it's not...
So at some point you had enough of the conspiracy theories and just like a couple of your colleagues, and then what happened?
Yeah, well, the party basically split here the whole story about the corona and everything also was a big problem within the party, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there were some quite creative theories there. Yes. that we will better not speak about. So then you were with the other colleagues who separated themselves from that party.
Yeah, let me call them the more let's say down to earth, more sensible people. But okay,
yeah. So you were back amongst the down to earth and sensible people, and then how close was that to your political views? I mean, you said, well, this gentleman approach you because of your he knew that where you stood politically. Where do you stand politically?
Well, it was kind of funny because, let's say, from outside they consider your party to be, let's say, right wing or let's say extreme right wing. And the funny thing is that once I was offered a simul in Paris, and so I sent them my CV, my chess CV, but then I thought, you know, maybe it's also interesting to send me my political CV. Yeah. And then my simul got cancelled.
Oh, really?
Yeah, this was kind of...
But then you had already left the forum for the...
Yeah. But nevertheless...
But you were still too...
Yeah, right. But nevertheless, let's say, still consider you, let's say, some extreme right-wing guy. So even, let's say, one famous organizer once called me a racist, you know. So okay, so I don't know. So, and the funny thing is, let's say from inside they consider me extremely left wing. So within the party,
in your current party,
my current party, so so it means that from outside they're putting pressure on me that they consider you as an extreme right wing guy, and within your own party consider you to be extreme left wing guy.
Yeah, so maybe you should help us and tell us what you think yourself.
Well, I don't really think in right and left, or but for example, now this is the big discussion about immigration and stuff like that. So I believe that, for example, people in Africa, they should be helped economically. But on the other hand, let's say you want to help, let's say, war refugees and people who are basically in trouble for their beliefs or whatever. If you don't have if you allow everybody to come to your country, fine, you cannot help. At some point it will stop. You can't really help the people who are really in need, let's say. So basically I also want to help them, but it's more about the how you solve this problem, not so, okay, and I believe also, well, ecologically, we have to solve some problems. How to solve them, I don't know. But, okay, I agree that there there are climate problems, but how to solve them, that's not very very simple. But the fact that, I mean, that you acknowledge that there's a problem, it's already put you already on the far left side, you know.
Within your party.
Yeah.
So that's so. Well, it's often been said that that chess teaches you qualities that you can use in other areas. To what extent did you feel that they helped you in politics, or that they were of use to you?
Well, actually, okay, I was just following the debates, and but you see how people are moving and changing sides, and I mean, this pattern recognition you had from chess, I mean, you see it, it's coming, you see it coming from far, what they're going to do, and sometimes you think yourself, do they really think I'm that stupid that, you know, I didn't see that one coming or what? It's like how they crawling and bending and, you know, and
well, that's definitely a completely new use of the concept of pattern recognition.
Well, but it's like, but yeah, that's true, but it's pattern recognition still, and yeah. You recognize how people are going to react and how they're going to behave, and
But there were not moments where you thought, here chess comes in handy. I mean, it really reminds me of something chess related.
No, well, you're able to analyze it pretty well, what's happening, but maybe mostly in the aftermath, you know, that's after you start to let it sink in, you know, and what just happened here, and since you're not that experienced, so let's say it needs normally some time before you realize what has actually happened, you know, and so at the moment itself, you just have to digest everything what just happened.
Yeah. Well, you said before you decided to go into politics, then you wanted to do some possible damage analysis, what it might do to your career. First you ended up in a party that was very controversial, and then in a party that is often seen as rather far right wing. How do you look back on this adventure? I mean, do you think it did do some damage, or do you see it as something that just was a very interesting experience?
No, I mean, basically overall, I'm kind of happy with this experience because we'll get this chance. So 4 years to be in that world, but I didn't really chose to be in politics, you know. If I would try to run again, then it would have been, then it would have been really my decision to try again, and that I want to continue like this. But after 4 years, I was, I had enough, and I was totally exhausted, you know, and frustrated. But okay, experience itself it was nice. And let's face it, in Corona times, chess players, they had not an easy life, and I was on the payroll of the government, which also, it eased the pain quite a bit.
And it was easier for you to continue your work than for the chess players.
Absolutely, yeah. So, yeah. But the fact that the party was controversial, I didn't really mind at all, you know, because I like to be controversial, you know, I like to express my opinion, although it might hurt some people's feelings, you know.
Yeah.
But also I had to realize that at some point this was going in really too far and in the wrong direction, that okay, I have to do something, otherwise it would not be so funny, you know.
Yeah, there were also things that you didn't necessarily want to be associated with.
Yeah, and also, well, let's say internally at home, you know, that my wife was actually kind of happy that I left the party, you know, so.
Yeah, I can understand.
This podcast is brought to you by DGT, the chess innovators. Discover your perfect chess friend. The DGT Centaur is a chess computer that automatically adapts itself to your playing strength. It gives you a fair chance to win, to learn, and most importantly, to have fun. To find your nearest DGT dealer, please visit our website at dgt.nl.
Another thing that played a prominent role in your career was your work as a second. You've worked with many prominent players. Yeah, the first big one was Gata Kamsky when he was playing for the FIDE World Championship against Karpov, and you were on his team in Ilista, which was the capital of Kalmykia, where many events took place at the time, and that was quite an adventure for you, wasn't it?
Yes, but one of the complications was, of course, Father Kamsky.
Yeah, so that for those who have forgotten him, he was the father of Rustam. Rustam was the father of Gata Kamsky, and quite a character. How would you sum him up, Luke?
Yeah, well, actually, they were, let's say, my parents, they were reading some stories in the newspaper, and then I called home and spoke to my mother.
When you were in Ilista.
In Ilista. And my mother said, basically, yeah, okay, but you survived your father for 25 years. This should be easy. But it was a bit. We had to work on under difficult circumstances, and we could have a special podcast on that experience, you know. But let's say if, for example, Father Kamsky is deciding which opening to play, although he has basically no chess knowledge, or he's totally paranoid and he claims that the house we are staying in is completely bugged, you know, and they're breaking down the house, and we cannot anyone take a shower in the house, you know, because everything is broken. So
why was it broken?
I mean, they were basically breaking down the house looking for bugs, you know, and
Rustam Kamsky, and he was doing that. He was looking for those.
I
remember a story you once told me that you were planning to take a bath and there was no water, and this was done on purpose by him.
Rustam is going with Gata to the game, and I just said, okay, maybe I like to take a bath, you know.
Yeah.
So, but there were some snitches in the house, you know, and they informed him that when the guy was going to play, that I was not working, but I was taking a bath. And so instead of that, Rustam tells me, like, okay, guy, you have to work. Yeah? No, so one day I go to take my bath, and then no water is coming out. So after that, I said, okay, come on, you cannot screw me like this. But there was some hot water still in the kitchen. So I took some bucket, you know, and went back and forth to try to fill the bath with hot water from the kitchen. Yeah. Anyway, just to take my bath. So, it was kind of...
What I also thought was rather typical, that he tried to test your physical reactions by suddenly attacking you from the back and trying to strangle you, and you had to wrestle free.
We have been wrestling,
but no damage done.
No, maybe to him, but not to me.
But still, let's say it was quite an experience, and I think it benefited your chess, because when you came back from that adventure, you played you had some nice results.
Yeah, I think around that time I crossed the 2600 barrier, which was kind of a big thing. It was actually the first time that you really worked seriously on chess with a high-level guy. And this was like the good old days. Like, you didn't work with computer. I mean, you basically had a computer for database purposes, yeah?
Yeah.
But you had to analyze yourself. You have to find ideas, and you have to test them in practice and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And basically, for example, Gata, he had all his notes written in some book, you know. Can you imagine these days? Yeah. That's like now it's impossible to imagine. And even worse, that I had my so-called analysis stored in my mind. So I was not even writing them down. And so basically, when Rustam asked me if where are your analysis? I said, well, they're in my mind. And then the guy was like,
he was trying to open your mind.
He was thought maybe he doesn't want to show me or what, he was kind of paranoia in this sense. Yeah, and because we're playing Karpov and old Soviet Union, and that's why they're very skeptical it would be a fair match. KGB was listening, and he felt like this was going to be there in the same way.
Yeah.
No proof for that, but...
It was a logical train of thought for him.
Yeah, well, I mean, they of course, I think they defected to the US like in maybe early 90s, end of 80s, something like that. So, I mean, they still were...
Yeah.
They know how things work in the Soviet Union.
Yeah. Well, one of the things is great to talk to you about this is because you've, experienced this for such a long time. I mean, the way the work as a second developed in the chess world, for me, it was some sort of a glimpse into the future when I met you at the World Championship Tournament in Mexico in 2007, when you were working for Vladimir Kramnik, and you were working in the night, so you got up late, and then we went for lunch. And then at some point you explained to me that Kramnik, he wanted you to analyze a position, and you had said, I've analyzed it, and the ending that we get after, I don't know, 22 or 24 moves is very promising. And he had said, I don't want to know if it is promising, I want to know if it's winning. And then I thought, that goes quite far. And that was only in 2007. What was your feeling then, that it was getting deeper and deeper or crazier and crazier?
Well, it's true that, let's say, after working with Kramnik, you start to think, is this going to be, how my life is going to look like in the future? Mm-hmm. Is this it, you know?
Yeah.
Because first of all, you had all this computerized analysis, and okay, 2007, I remember that back in the days that he was working a lot with Fritz.
Yeah.
And I was actually ahead of him, because I was working with multiple engines at the same time. I was working with both Ripka and Junior to get the right spectrum of moves. And he was working with his stupid Fritz, and I was kind of making him look stupid, And at some point the guy said, okay, now tell me which engine you're using now, because he was getting smashed in analysis every time. And it was kind of hard for me to say, okay, Vladi, okay, this is not how we're going to work, because, what's the guy like? 5-time world champion or whatever. So this all this crazy computerized analysis, and back in the days, at least you had some own input, and now your input is getting smaller and smaller, and you feel really stupid, what they call pressing the space bar.
Yeah.
And this was not going to be very funny work. Although I must say that I was pretty good at it, because Vladimir was using this his beloved Fritz, and I was using multiple engines like Ripka and Junior, and actually I was kind of making him look very stupid in analysis, which was kind of making him desperate to scream at me like, which engine are you using now? And he had this method of working, and I would say, I felt, okay, of course, I was kind of important for him to advise him on some things, but still, it was a bit hard for me to tell him, okay, Vladi, listen, this is not how we're going to work, because the guy was actually kind of successful as a multiple world champion.
Yeah.
But, he wanted this crazy computer analysis, that he let the computer run all night, and then you have to check this analysis, looking for some gem here and there. He showed me, for example, once he showed me some analysis. He said, yeah, can you check this? Probably it's nothing. And then I analyzed a bit. I found some interesting ideas, and the guy suddenly got very excited. And then he said, like, okay, now analyze all moves till the end. So this was kind of a change. And I don't believe it's so practical. And I think I still have the level to tell him, okay, guy, this is not so practical. Let's say, for example, when working with Toplov, you work on a much more practical level than, let's say, Kramnik was doing.
Yeah, you also worked with Topalov.
Yeah. And and basically, when the guy wants to play a line, I still had, let's say, at that time, I was like 26-80. So I tell him, like, I really don't want you to play this line, because this line is well, doesn't feel good. Let's say, as you said, doesn't feel promising. But yeah, he liked to have this and everything analyzed till the very end.
Yeah. Well, now it's, let's say, 17 years fast forward. We're waiting for the candidates tournament in Toronto to start. One of the major events this year. Do you think that people have any idea how deep the preparation of those players is, and could you give them a peek into that, the kind of work they're doing these days, and to what extent it has developed from those moments when you worked with Kramnik, and how much further they are now?
Yes, well, I must say that. Okay, let's say back in the days, you had to all figure it out by yourself. Mm-hmm. This is, in my opinion, the most interesting period, because you have to...
Yeah, no engines, just brain.
Yeah, and you really develop the line by yourself, yeah? Mm-hmm. And then later you have the engines. It was checking for tactical mistakes, and later they improved them. But, you know, let's say in 2000, when I won my first Dutch championship, Frits was actually allowed to play the Dutch championship. Yeah. And I made Frits look really stupid, you know. This was kind of,
which was still possible then.
Yeah, still have some sweet memories about that.
Yeah.
But then, engines gradually start to improve. And now, you had this, of course, then when Deep Blue beat the Kasparov was already something. But now, actually, from... scientific point of view, is very interesting how this this, for example, Leela with the AI and or these cloud engines, you know, how much power they have these days, and actually that they come up with some new evaluations with some new moves which they would kind of violate, let's say, the old basic laws of chess. So you really have to re-evaluate how you look at chess, how you perceive things.
So, but things are still going deeper and deeper. I mean, there's more and more that they have to recall.
I'm not necessarily think it's going deeper, but let's say it's going to be re-evaluated. So what your perception was good or bad, and it judgment will change. Let's say this is very interesting part in my opinion. And
also because these assessments, they differ from what humans would assess in the first place.
Yes, and they come up with moves that you as a human you would not think about it, but since the engine is shown this move, you have to think. So you have to take it seriously, and then you have to think why this is good. It's some kind of retrograde exercise. Yeah, you have to think about. You see first the right move, and then you have to think why. First, you back in the days, you have the principles, and then you find the solution. But now it's all the way around.
You have to think backwards.
Yes. And then. Maybe you can use it for your chess, but still it's kind of hard, you know.
Yeah, well, there's 8 players there, Luke, and they're all armed to the teeth. Who do you think and who do you hope will win in Toronto?
Let's be realistic. That I believe Abasov has. I don't like his chances.
Okay. So that leaves seven.
Seven, yeah. And yeah. let's say Fabi, he played very well last year. So it could be a good indication. But actually, the best indication is actually the one who really played badly in Wijkaan Zee. Because I think before Ding did well in the candidates, he played very badly in Wijkaan Zee. And I think there was...
Well, also Caruana, he had a very bad result there.
Yes. Yeah. So playing some badly in Wijkaan Zee, it helps a lot for whatever reason. Yes. I mean, also some careers have been finished in Wijkaan Zee,
So that would mean...
You have Fabi, you have Naka, you have Vidit, you have
Pragnananda,
Ferugia.
So who do you think? Or who do you hope? Let's first start with who do you hope, Luke?
Well, to be honest, I think Pragnananda is a very dark horse to me. Mm-hmm. I like the way he's playing and how he has been improving.
Yeah, he's really been growing tremendously and he's reached a stability that is very impressive. Yeah.
Because to be honest with you, if you allow me to be honest.
Well, for this month.
Because I saw him, I don't know how many years ago, but I saw him playing in Netherlands in the city Apeldoorn. I don't know how many years it was, like 10 years maybe or whatever. And I thought, well, this guy is so untalented. but he proved me wrong.
Yeah, yeah. Why did you think that?
Well, I mean, he was like 2,500, but his way of playing chess, I thought, well, with some people you feel it, you know, that they have the natural understanding of chess, and
you didn't see it yet in him at that time.
Not at all.
No. So you see him as a possible winner. Any hopes for, I mean, are you rooting for someone or not really?
No, actually, I always love to follow the candidates because it's always great chess to watch.
Yeah.
And I have a lot of free time, so I will be drinking a lot of coffee, or I will eat a lot of popcorn I will be enjoying it a lot.
Yeah.
And it's a bit, you always want, let's say, the world championship match to be very interesting. Yeah. But now nobody knows what's happening to Ding.
Yeah. But so, okay, that's the other side. You would have to think who would be the perfect opponent for Ding.
Yeah. But what I'm hoping for, I don't know. I like the way Fabi is playing. I always liked his. He's just always no excuse, and he's always fighting. And
He's been immensely strong this year. Huh?
Yeah, and and also I noticed that he's also not backing down. You know,
he's a brave warrior.
Yeah, and this is what I like.
Yep. Okay, look. Well, that has gone very quickly. Time flies. I'm very grateful that you wanted to join us, and I hope it's not the last time that we talk about wondrous things in the world of chess. So thank you very much. Is there a final word that you want to say to the listeners?
No, I hope that this is just the beginning of many podcasts, DJ, and that the listeners will demand more.
Yes, they want the return of King Luke and others.
Well, maybe they want the return of the politician of King Luke or whatever they want. They just have to send in their request and
Yes, we will let them judge. But for the moment, well, thanks a lot for being with us. It was a great pleasure, as always. And, we'll be in touch.
Absolutely, DJ. See you soon in The Hague.
Absolutely. That's how it will go. Take care.
Thank you.